Common Reason Ministries is celebrating 15 years of sharing life-changing truth, and you're invited to join the celebration. Now through August 31st, 2025, you can order any of our 15-plus books absolutely free, with free shipping to U.S. addresses. But don't wait, this special offer is only available while supplies last. Visit comeandreason.com. Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists here at Honey Lake, and James Johnson, the Chief of Chaplains here at Honey Lake. And we're again privileged today to be joined by Katie McPherson. And I'm going to let her introduce herself in just a second. But our topic today for our program is parental stress at an all-time high and what we can do. And that's what we're going to be talking about. And let's introduce Katie. And Katie, tell us a little about your background and what you bring to our discussion.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm a career educator. I've been in the schools for about 30 years, and I'm also a parent of four teenagers.
Okay, girls, boys?
All girls.
Oh, boy. That must be tough.
Yeah, it's a small estrogen.
Girls are always, I've heard everyone tell that girls are more difficult to raise than boys. Everyone says it. And they're actually more expensive to raise than boys.
They're very expensive.
Is that true?
That is true.
I believe it. Mm-hmm. My mom says that. My mom had two boys and a girl, and she, you know, my younger sister, she said, was far more stressful than the two of us combined. So,
and they're more expensive. They have a lot more just expenses than boys.
What does that mean?
Well, the girl, you don't know? Well, the way my mom always explained it was that boys were more rowdy and rambunctious when they were younger, but as they get older, things kind of simplify and their, you know, life desires are a little bit easier, whereas girls are maybe easier in the younger years, but psychodynamically and socially, it's much more complicated and stressful in the teenage years. And I'm sure Katie could probably speak more to that, so her education and life experience.
I'm talking about expenses.
Yeah.
Just go to the store sometime and look at some clothing for boys and clothing for girls. See what the expenses are. So look at the hair, keeping the hair up for a girl,
skincare.
And hair for a boy, the makeup and skincare for a girl, the manicures and pedicures for a girl, the on and on it goes. Girls are more expensive. The jewelry that girls buy versus boys. On and on it goes. It's not bad. It's just reality. Girls are more expensive to raise in our society than boys are.
Yeah, I never got any of that. So, so I didn't think about that.
And what family dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't forget the eyelashes. The fake eyelashes are very expensive.
So I just have always heard that. But what are the primary causes in today's society of parental stress? What are parents stressing over?
Well, I don't have four girls like Katie does. We only have two, but they're teenagers as well. And probably one of the greatest stressors in our life is just time. You know, it feels like there's school during the day. You got to get them up in the morning, get them going to school. Then when you come home, you've got projects or homework.
How old are your
13 and 15. So our youngest daughter is into theater.
And you've got to get them up?
Well, so
I just heard you say we got to get them up. Maybe I shouldn't go there, but
well, you know what? One of the things that we talked about in the different episode is letting your children develop that resiliency. And so I do need to improve on. I still, as the dad, love to wake them up in the morning and be silly and sing songs and stuff like that. And so we are working on, especially now that our 15-year-old is starting to do, you know, part-time work here and there, that you've got to set your alarms. You've got to get yourself up. So I do need to work on that resiliency and move that boundary out. You're pointing some stuff out, Doc. I get it.
But the stress.
There's just so much going on that, you know, our youngest daughter's in theater, so she's got rehearsals to get to, which is a very different location from our oldest daughter, who's very big into dance and ballet and point. And so she's got to be in a different location. So my wife and I are having to split because neither of them are independent drivers yet. So we're having to take them to those places. We're having to, you know, make sure that we're helping them with their schedules and make sure we're getting all the places, all the time, all the deadlines. And it just feels like there's just more and more every year that we go through on the schedule. Church is part of it, all those things.
So before you add in any others, do you agree with what he's describing, that all the things that kids are into is a stress on the parents?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I'm from a different generation. And I'm going to suggest that is there a place to have a conversation related to whether, in fact, those are appropriate things for parents to accept as responsibilities, or as parents have bought into some idea that's actually fraudulent? I can tell you, growing up, all of us kids in my home had stuff we wanted to do. Tons of stuff that we wanted to do through our school, through these activities, whether it was, you know, it wasn't ballet for us, but it was various ball games we wanted to go to, or trips or other activities going on through the school that we wanted to do. And we didn't get to do them all. My parents had limited time and limited budget. And one of those two would often result in, and because limited time, three of us want to do something simultaneously, one car. Y'all don't get to go unless the kid could arrange with a friend to get a ride to an event. Then sometimes you would get permission to go because a family friend can swing by and pick you up, one of your classmates or something. But my parents didn't take the ownership that it was their responsibility to get us to all these different things. And I didn't get to go to a lot. I will tell you, there was a lot of stuff that happened at my school that I didn't get to go to either because of time constraints or financial constraints. It had a fee associated with it, and we were not well off. We couldn't afford that. Do I think that my development as an individual was impaired by that? No, I don't think so at all. I think that was reality. I learned how reality works. Mm-hmm. I learned how prioritization and decision-making works. I learned how sacrifice works. I learned how hard work benefits. And if I wanted something that was important to me and I worked really hard for it, and I would actually problem solve and I would actually work to try to coordinate it so that it would happen if I really wanted it, and I would go and maybe get a little extra job and make a little money to help my parents out for it, and other, rather than just having my parents have to own that they have to do this for me. I'm wondering if a lot of parents, I'm just putting out there, are parents stressed because they've got bad boundaries and they take stuff on themselves they shouldn't take? I don't know. What do you think?
Yes. Yes, yes, and yes. And I would say moms really shoulder a lot of that stress. Not that dads aren't stressed, but moms are still the primary person that's home before and after school and sort of managing the household, in my experience at least. And so there's just this innate stress around, is my kid doing enough? And if they're not doing enough, and again, this sort of race for performance starts in pre-kindergarten. You know, when I went to kindergarten, we had a carpet square, we got three recesses and a nap. And now kindergarten, they're like doing third grade math. And there's all of this academic pressure that starts pushing, and then sports. You know, I've got a nephew who's teeny tiny and he's in competitive football and he is grinding like all week, all weekend. And it's just, there's all of these outside stressors that are impacting that, not to mention the economy and how expensive everything is. And so parents are trying to keep up with the expense of just keeping the family afloat as well.
So I'm wondering if it's, as you look at those parental stressors, you've articulated it's coming sometimes from society and parental need to compare to others. I agree. That's one factor. What about from fear of disappointing the child? The child will cry. All my friends get to, I don't get to go. I see that as a big pressure, and the parents not knowing how to tolerate the disappointment in their child. If the child, and I got to tell you, I was disappointed on many things, and my parents had the attitude of, "Hey, if you come up with the money, you can go." Okay, we don't got the money. And as looking back, my mom, when I became an adult, told us that was very hard on her because she wanted to have the money for us. We didn't have the money. But I actually had a friend whose family was in high school, one of my high school friends whose family is well off, But they took the position that they would not buy. He had to fund this because they wanted to teach him this type of responsibility. So even though they could, they wouldn't, because they wanted him to learn how to work and learn these principles of self-reliance and the value of a dollar and those types of things. So, you know, where's the balance there for how much a parent actually does and how much a parent lets them not experience and go through the emotional disappointment unless they come up with a means to do it themselves? Where's that balance?
I'd ask Danielle too. What I found is there's a lot of internal wounds with the parents. And so I hear a lot, which I'm so tired of hearing, like, I had a crappy childhood and so I want to give my kid everything. And so these internal, like, childhood wounds of the adult are being sort of like, I don't even know the word, like, they're overextending themselves to give their children what they didn't have. And in turn, the coping and resilience and social competence of this kids is ultra low, which is then leading to the things that I would assume that Danielle's seeing in her office.
Yes, absolutely. And similarly to that, I've heard a lot of parents specifically, even explicitly say, I'm trying to do the opposite and swinging to the opposite extreme and it being honestly selfish and not motivated out of love, but out of insecurity. There was, you know, to be very vague, right? I don't want to be super specific, but somebody who they didn't feel like their parent ever did what they wanted to do. It was always what my parents want to do. And so what she did was she compensated by, with her children, making sure they did a bunch of fun stuff. But ironically, it was still just the fun stuff she wanted to do. So she made the exact same mistake, but with the rationale, oh, this is, you know, I'm doing the opposite of what my parents wanted to do. But it was motivated out of selfishness rather than love. Yeah.
So one idea, and we've kind of talked about it, is parents are stressed with time. What other things are stressing parents?
Well, we've talked about it in another segment, but like taking care of themselves, nutrition for the parent. You know, people are like running around, running to soccer, running to lacrosse. They're grabbing Chick-fil-A and McDonald's. They're not eating well themselves as the parent. They're not healthy. I mean, I have many friends that are taking Ozempic to lose weight instead of having a healthy diet, exercising, taking time for self-care. So I feel like the nutrition piece and the sleep piece for the parent themselves is just as important as we've talked about for the kids as well.
So you've just articulated beautifully a principle that I teach caregivers. The first rule of caregiving and parenting is caregiving. Whether you realize it or not, they're in the role of the caregiver for the child. And the first rule of caregiving is the health of the caregiver. Because if the caregiver becomes unhealthy and incapacitated, they not only can't do the caregiving that is their responsibility, but now they need somebody else to care for them. And if they're not maintaining their health, and we have many patients that we've seen who come from homes in which one of the parents or both, but one of the parents ended up so unhealthy, the child as a child ended up in the role of caring for the parent.
Yes.
Okay. And so I think that's well said, that, you know, parents have to establish those parameters that are the minimum requirement to maintain the health and wellness. And that would be sleep hours. These are our sleep hours. This is my exercise, physical routine. This is my meditation, spiritual time with the Lord. This is the, you know, whatever those things are that are required for physiological, spiritual, and parental time, date night, whatever for the parents, because that relationship has to be maintained and healthy. And all those get set. And then you come back and say, okay, now we're going to, as caregivers, we want to do healthy things with our children. What does that look like? And where does that get put in? But you don't allow the concern and love for the children to encroach upon all of the healthy routines that maintain parental resilience and health. When I say encroach, obviously the exception being true emergencies. Your child is in the emergency room with anaphylactic shock. You will stay up all night and not get your sleep. Okay. True emergencies can intrude into those routines, but true emergencies only last brief periods, and then you're back into your routines. Okay. A child's, pardon?
I think the word routine is what a lot of people are missing. Like, I just watch friends and colleagues and people in the community, like, they lack those boundaries and routines and are running themselves ragged. And then sometimes that leads to the adult using substances or their phone to sort of escape from the real world. And then we have teenagers that are like, should I experiment with a vape? Should I experiment with pot? And they're watching their parent do those things to escape from the stress.
No, and I think that's because the priorities have not actually been at least consciously understood. And I think the parents overextend and because they want to do good. And they haven't understood that their first responsibility, you know, you love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. If you're not actually maintaining health for yourself, you're not actually able to love your neighbor. Mm. And you end up being a burden to everybody. And so there has to be this primary maintenance of one's wellness so that one can be in great service to the community or to their family or whatever. I think many people miss that because of the heart desire to do good for others, whether it's the family. I've seen this in pastors. Chaplain, seeing this in pastors who overextend in their church family because they have so many needs, and then they end up burning out and exhausting rather than actually making this principle first. I have to maintain my health and wellness first. And if they look at Jesus as the role model, he took time away from needy masses all the time to rest and recover and spend time with his Father. And that's and so that he could maintain his balance in doing his role as our Savior. So I think that's a great principle for parents is to establish that. I suspect if we looked at parents who are stressed, at least 9 out of 10 of them do not have that healthy routines to maintain their balance. I would bet that's true. Do you think that's wrong to say?
No, not at all. No.
Go ahead. Yeah, Danielle.
Something else I want to add to that is the importance of a supportive community. So a lot of what I see in parents that come in here who are stressed is they don't have people around them supporting them, helping to, you know, the kids are growing up with one another, but the parents are learning from one another, collaborating, but they end up moving into an isolation where their primary or almost only social situation is just with the family itself. So in some cases, the mom's only socialization is with the kids and her husband is emotionally absent. And so she relies on the kids for emotional needs met. And that's a pattern I actually see
that's very good.
Yeah. So adding to the routine, I think something that gets missed is the importance of like what you were saying, like spending time with friends, like other moms who can share in experiences.
So I'm going to support that totally, but actually say it in maybe this way, because I think some parents might be shocked as I say this, but reducing parental stress and helping parents have resilience, doesn't it require parents have time away from their children?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what you were saying without saying it that way. With peers.
Yes.
Yes. Away, time away from their children. And some parents.
I wake up very early and I joke around that I get up before the crowds. And by the crowds, I mean my children because I have 4. And it's a crowd and someone's crying and screaming about, you have my jeans, you stole my makeup. All the things. And you have to dedicate that time. Otherwise, you won't get it. And it has to be intentional.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
One of the other stresses, I think, at least maybe this is just my experience, is I feel it's almost kind of like moving to a different country and you're not part of the culture, that my girls are part of a different generation. Mm-hmm. They speak a different language. They have different things that they care about. They have, and I know that's probably true of every set of parents, that maybe my parents felt the same way about my generation. But one of the things that I feel is unique about this generation compared to the ones that have come before is the openness to information, the openness to what's out there in the world, that, you know, in good and bad. You know, that I used to have to, if I wanted to learn something, I had to get a ride to the library, hope that my small town library had a book on it or the encyclopedia talked about it. And now they're aware of all these things going on in the world, from politics to, you know, international conflicts, you know, legal and legislative decisions, not just the social struggles. And so I feel stressed about not being able to connect to my kiddos as much as I want to. And that means that I've got to constantly be learning. And while that's fun to learn what they love and what they're into, that does require me to put energy into that. And I feel like a lot of times I feel very out of touch because I don't know what they're talking about or what they're into.
So either one in the room, anybody,
What have you identified any actions that help bridge that gap, that help you make that connection? What strategies are you employing or tried? Any suggestions on how to make that generational gap connect?
Well, I get silly with them and try to say, hey, tell me what that word means. And I practice it with them and they laugh at me because if I, they were teaching me about the word Riz the other day, you know, short for charisma. And so I'll on purpose try to use it in everyday language and they think that's funny. But, you know, it's that conversation with them, that intentionality to say, I don't know what you're talking about. Help me out with that. Or I've never heard of that. Tell me about that. But that does require an intentional investment on my part to say, tell me more about these things that you're into and that you're talking about. But it also is all kinds of fun to learn new words that I have no clue how to use them anymore. So I'm not hip anymore.
So Katie, any thoughts on that question that you've strategies you found are helpful?
I really love car time, like carpooling or car time. Like I learned so much about them, even if I like pretend to turn up the radio and I like pretend I'm just driving alone and they're all talking. And so I get a lot of intel from that. And then later when I'm alone with them, you know, I'll make up an errand, like I have to go to Sprouts, come with me. And I'll be like, tell me more about that. You know, I mean, these kids, like you said, know like the climate change and the politics and like they're talking about things that I have to go research myself. And so the car time for me, the shoulder to shoulder interaction specifically where we're not interfacing and we're having this like back and forth conversation, they will tell me all sorts of things that I didn't know, both personal things about what they're going through and world events and things like that. So I just love driving around with them because now they all drive. And so when I get that car time with them, it's like very precious to me.
Daniel, you had something you wanted to say or?
Yeah, well, I think that's great. And I wanted to add on to what Pastor James said, specifically from the perspective of the child, maybe in that dynamic. My mom did that with me. She was very joyful and curious and excited about the different words I was using. And it became something that was lighthearted and fun and something I could teach her about something in my world. And her interest in that was a good way for us to connect. So
yeah, thank you. That makes me feel a little bit better. Yeah. That made him a better parent than I gave myself credit for.
Yeah. And then she'd use those words and it was hilarious. Yeah. And she still uses words from 15 years ago, thinking that they're the new ones. Yeah.
Cowabunga.
Yeah.
So parental stress and resilience. We've talked about the stressor of time, the stressor of connecting. And you've talked about trying to, you know, have those words. The studies have shown that the children who grow up with the greatest health and resilience, do best, come from homes in which they have a family member confidant. There's two factors. One, a family member confidant, somebody that they can actually come home from whatever it is and confide and talk about. I was teased. I was bullied. This happened on our social network, whatever. And somebody they can actually process those life stressors, that somebody confide in. That's one of the big ones. And the other one is that as a family, the whole family is experiences having each other's back. We don't out each other. We don't turn on each other in public. When we're together, we know there's somebody that's on our side, always on our side. That emotional context, that family cohesion, and that family member confidant. Now, the question I have for the two parents in the room, it seems quite a delicate balance to be able to be the parental, appropriate authority who establishes where those boundaries are, the disciplinarian, which comes from the word disciple, meaning to teach, okay, so that you hold accountable, and still creating an atmosphere where the child will come to you and confide in something without fear of punishment. You know, that seems to be a very, very delicate balance. And I don't know if we want to have a conversation. I've got some ideas about it, but a conversation of how the parent can be that appropriate, structured, loving disciplinarian, and it doesn't cause the child to fear the parent finding out so that they keep secrets. They actually come and talk to you. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, for me, one of the things that I've been so grateful for is learning about how God's design laws work. that because it's not, you know, that shaped my relationship with God to say God is no longer the bully with the magnifying glass in an ant farm who just wants to zap me, that everything bad happens to me is a punishment from God, rather than learning that if I step outside of God's design laws, I bring the punishment on myself. And so when I try to do that with my own children, when I do it well, is they understand these are the choices in front of you in your life, whatever that is, homework, time management, whatever. If you don't do that well, this is the consequence you bring on yourself. I'm not the bad guy. You have the responsibility and the choice to do that. And what that allows to happen is even when I have to say, you knew if you didn't do this thing, this was going to be the consequence. You made a decision. You chose that. And now the consequence is here. I'm not the one that's bringing that. They're bringing it on themselves. And that allows me to still be a disciplinarian to help teach them. But when I do it well, it also allows me to not break trust or love relationship with them, because it's not an, oh, impending, I have to do this to keep Dad happy with me. It's, you know, Dad is a safe space and the punishment I brought on myself.
So you want to make clear that any discipline is a stand between them and the ultimate consequence to help teach or educate them so they don't suffer the ultimate, like discipline for not brushing their teeth so they won't get cavities, or discipline so that they play in the street, they won't get hit by a car. Whatever the discipline is, your discipline is not actually punishment.
Right.
That comes from the word punitive, means to take vengeance upon. It's to disciple or teach. And it's done because you love them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's done well, then the children look back at some point and realize, thank you so much. Okay. If it's done well, but which means there has to be a demeanor element. You can't be doing it in anger. You can't be doing it when you're frustrated. You can't be doing it when you're irritated. You have to be doing it in a calm and even loving tone, but you're still doing it. Katie, you want to say something about this? How do you find that balance?
Oh, gosh. So when the girls were little, we had the no trouble bubble. So they could come and tell me anything within this bubble. And it was like me, like, this is the no trouble bubble. Whatever you tell me, there may be a consequence. I am going to hold you accountable. But whatever you have, I am here to listen to that. I think in two parent households where you have sort of the listener empath, and then you have sort of the strategist like hammer, and it can be any two people, and one person can serve both roles. But what I have found, it is a tricky balance, but what I have found is when I can listen and be empathic, but also strategize with them so that they're doing the heavy lifting of whatever the issue is, I'm building that competence and that confidence, which also is the resiliency piece of this, to protect them from some of the things that they're up against. So when they were little, it was the no trouble bubble. It is now, and this happens often, the lights are off. It's 10 o'clock. I'm asleep. We're asleep. They come in and sit on the end of the bed and they're just like, duh, duh. So I have to tell you something and I don't know how to tell you this. And it's pitch black. And so I get up and, you know, I'm that listener and empath. And sometimes there's a consequence. You know, I'll give you an example. My oldest, I speak on prevention for a living. I have told her thousands of times, do not put something in your mouth that you don't know where it came from. She came home high as a kite after eating a teeny tiny bit of an edible at a party at age 18, and she was sick as a dog. And I sat with her and watched all the things that happened after she ate that edible, and there was a consequence. But again, that safety to come to me and say, I took this, so that we were aware that she had taken something that is legal in the state of Arizona that is impacting her physical health, is so important, that communication is open and they can come to us with anything.
That's great. That's really great. So I'm wondering if many parents are stressed because they haven't developed that balance, and thus they know something's going on with their kid. They try to reach out to the kid because maybe the kid is sulking. The kid is looks angry. The kid looks worried or stressed, and they try to talk, but the kid won't talk to them. I wonder if that adds parental stress. Any strategies if they haven't already had this long-standing, understood trust, the trouble bubble and all these things, they haven't had that built in. What can a parent do today to help maybe build that bridge where the kid will start coming and talking, because the parent can feel it, the parent's stressed. But any suggestions for those parents?
Well, one of the things that's been helpful for me is it's stressful in a different way is when I tell them, you know, I love that no trouble bubble. I love that idea that, you know, I say, you know, this is a judgment-free zone. You can tell me whatever you're going to say, and I'm not going to judge you or condemn you for it. Your feelings, thoughts, beliefs about whatever in the situation. And the thing I have to be careful to do, I'm a fixer. So somebody presents a problem to me, I want to tell them how to fix it. And so when I tell them this is a judgment-free zone and I'm not going to, you know, give you any of this criticism or whatever, I actually have to keep my word. And that's the hard part is that when I tell them I'm a safe space to come and share these things with, if I react in a way that is condemning, if I act in a way that is against what I told them that time was for, they're not going to have that trust in me. So when they do show that trust, I nurture the trust by keeping my word and being truthful to it rather than doing what I want to do, which is fix the problems or, you know, bring the condemnation from it.
So I'm going to... I don't want to disagree with you because I agree with the principle that you're saying. I agree.
It's okay. Put it back. Tell me what's up.
No, I agree completely with the principle. What you're describing is creating a safe place, just like the where they can come and confide without retaliation.
Right.
That's what you're describing.
Yes. And I like how Katie said there are consequences.
Right. No, I agree with that.
But
I don't agree. I personally could not use, and maybe it works for you, I could not use the word judgment because the word judgment to me is assessment and diagnosis.
There's condemnation.
Yeah. Condemnation. That. Yes. Yes. I won't condemn.
Right.
Yes. In fact, they're asking for you to make a judgment.
Yes.
They're asking for you to evaluate what could I have done differently. They're asking for you to criticize it in a constructive way to help them learn how to make better decisions. So,
right.
So, but yes, I agree.
Judgment in the sense of condemnation. Not as in, oh, you made a
right
decision.
Right, in the judicial, I'm going to punish you condemnation way, but in the sense of your wisdom, you're going to judge the circumstances and evaluate the pros and cons and help them walk that journey.
Make an assessment.
So I just picking at one word.
No, that's the struggle of words, you know, which connotation we mean by it. And I'm glad you made that because maybe me saying judgment-free zone may bring the connotation to our listeners that, oh, I can't tell them that what they did was unwise.
Yes, I didn't want that to be heard. Right. No, we you know, the parent, they absolutely need to hear the truth spoken back to them in love, but without the sense of you are now cast off, you're a bad person, I don't love you anymore. But this is where that distinction comes where, you know, you can say, no matter what you've done, my love for you will not change.
That's right.
But my love for you does not prevent the consequences to choice. You know, if you ate the edible, I'm going to love you just as much. I don't love you less because you ate the edible, but your function changed. The way you feel changes. Your neurobiology for a period of time has changed. If you keep doing it, you're going to harm your neurobiology over time. So yes, thanks for talking to me. And I'm not judging in the condemnation sense, but let's make a judgment together over whether that was wise to do and whether, and then what happened in that circumstance that you didn't remember our wisdom not to put something in your mouth that you haven't vetted its source.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not cleaning up your vomit.
Yes. Yes. And you clean up your own vomit.
I mean, there are natural consequences to your actions. And I say that with love, all the love in the world. Love you so much, Mia, but we made a poor decision. There's a natural consequence. I'm going to sit here and make sure you're safe. Because I had no idea. I mean, I didn't know if the edible had fentanyl in it. I mean, she has no idea, right? I think these like one-liners, what I have heard over and over from parents that call me is they need help with their one-liners. Like when kids make mistakes, typical mistakes, experimenting with substances, whatever that they're driving too fast, like whatever the thing is, having those golden guardrails around them that we've been talking about over these last couple segments, but also having that natural consequence and then pushing through, like, we're going to get you to the other side of this, but you're going to do the heavy lifting. We're going to be here. You're 15, you're 17, like you're 12, whatever the thing is, knowing that they have that safe space, but you're going to develop this resilience after making this decision that maybe wasn't the best. I hear from parents a lot, like, how could you be so dumb? I can't believe you did this. In a year, this won't matter. Suck it up, buttercup, like all of these very dismissive one-liners that I think they're trying to drive motivating better behavior next time, but they actually push the child away.
Yeah, I'm just, wow. Those comments are foreign to my reflex, honestly. And I'm just processing what it must be like for a child who is coming to a parent after a difficult decision, a mistake. And the response is one of, how could you have been so stupid?
It happens all too often.
That does shut down the avenues of communication, I would bet.
Yeah. And or something like, I'm feeling anxious or I think I'm depressed. And they're like, you're fine. I had problems when I was your age. You're fine. And this general dismissiveness about the kid as a whole, like we tell kids all the time, come to us, come to us, come to us. And then they come to us. And if our response doesn't buffer empathy with sort of that next strategy, right? So let's say mom, this has happened to me. My daughter came home super upset about a boy who said something gross. So she's telling the story over and over and over in this loop. I stop her after two loops. And then my husband is stepping in like, okay, we've heard this story a couple of times. This is extremely painful. What are you going to do tomorrow? So the fixer, the strategist steps in is like, let's move her off this neural loop, because if we don't, it's going to become sort of permanent, right? Like, how do we get her to be the strategist? Like, what are you going to say to this kid tomorrow to help her feel confident to be her own problem solver?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
But a lot of parents take those situations in and like are super stressed themselves about it and call the school and call the kid's parents, and you know, then the stress level is extremely high.
So unless it's an actual real world threat of harm, if some kid and you actually perceive your child was being bodily threatened with harm, then parents need to intervene to protect. The emotional kind of things that kids say that are rude and offensive and ugly and emotionally hurtful, it's actually best to help the child learn to deal with, process, and understand, as you're saying, and not for the parent to intervene and defend that stuff. You know, what are you going to do tomorrow? Great. What does it actually mean? What does that person reveal to you about them that they would speak this way? From the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good man brings forth good out of the good stored up in him. The evil man brings forth the evil as the evil stored up in him. Jesus said, it is a point of truth that other people's behaviors and conducts tell you things about them, not about you, even if they're speaking about you. So when they said Jesus has a demon, they actually weren't telling us about Jesus. They were telling us about how they saw Jesus. Okay. And so the same thing. So helping them learn, this is a life lesson that a lot of young people, in fact, a lot of adults we even see here don't know, that if somebody is saying ugly words about you, that they're actually telling you something about them. And where it's most people are most vulnerable, if the ugly words about you or about something you personally are uncomfortable with. A child with acne gets called some ugly slander about their acne because they objectively have acne. They will take that very personally and feel inadequate. But even though they may have acne, or a child who's obese who gets called ugly words about their obesity, they're insecure about it. Because they're insecure about it, they are so vulnerable to failing to see the still truth that other person showing they're cruel, they're unkind, they don't love, they're mean-spirited, they're not trustworthy, they're not somebody that can be your friend. Okay, and they're revealing to you who they are. And so rather than feeling hurt by their words, you actually say, wow, thanks for letting me know you're the kind of person I don't want to hang out with, and you've got a lot of issues in your life. I'll pray that you actually mature, overcome whatever your insecurities are that cause you to feel the need to say ugly words to somebody like me so you can feel better about yourself.
Unfortunately, the school, like this happens in schools all the time, and kids bring this home to parents who become stressed. It's, well, he's a bully and you're a victim. And that framework is killing our kids on all sorts of levels.
Will you unpack that some? Because I hear all the time, you know, bullying, cyberbullying, all this stuff. And then, you know, this idea of, oh, you're the victim. Can you unpack that a little bit more for the parents that are listening and me?
Yeah. I mean, I don't believe that children are born bullies. I believe that conflict is inevitable. abuse of power by some children and adults is likely, and that every child has inherent worth and dignity, and we should be teaching our kids when they have these typical conflicts. So I hate the word bullying, because a lot of what happens in schools and communities is mean, annoying, and rude behavior. It's unwanted, but it happens. It's inevitable. Yes, do we have malicious harassment and intimidation? Yes, that's when I want parents calling and swooping in. But this lower level stuff, the 95% of what happens in our schools are two tiny brains who are not fully developed having a conflict that we have labeled as bully victim. And then we do this crazy thing where we send the bully home for 5 days to go home to the environment that possibly created that with no support. And then we take the victim and we sort of coddle the victim. And those two kids rarely have an opportunity to interface with each other and say, why would you say that to me? And this kid, well, last week you said this, and have like a normal, typical kid conflict where that vocabulary is going back and forth. And both children are like, I'm standing up for my dignity. That's when those kids will respect each other. I find we at the school level specifically, and even in homes with multiple siblings, when we're like, well, you should have known better. You guys say sorry. You go over there. You go over there. That is not helping. We are exiting children from these schools who, again, academic achievers, but have very low social competence because the framework of bully victim has been presented to them for the last 20 years. We told them, you can't handle it. I, as the administrator, am going to swoop in. You over there. You over there. Call in home. And it's just, not working.
No, I agree with you completely. And I want to actually even take it a step farther. And that is because I see a lot of patients who have been victimized. And I mean victimized in ways that maybe they were raped. Okay. So physical assault, victimization. But victimization, where you could be a victim of a crime, does not make you a victim of life. And many patients, because of this upbringing, this idea of bully, you're the victim, they start formulating an identity of a victim, a hapless victim who is, and I teach them, no, you may have been victimized, but whether you become a victim or a victor is up to you. And we reframe this and how you can take their misconduct against you that wounded you and how you reprocess that to heal the wounds and gain mastery where you become a victor over those life circumstances. You're not a victim to that. But what happens many times with this coddling of the world that we are doing is that when somebody has been victimized, is they get labeled the victim. And then they get put into some type of, you know, therapy with some therapist who then reinforces their victimhood and teaches them all this kind of, you know, psychobabble, non-coping strategies. And I see Danielle shaking her head. You've seen this too. And the rest of their life, they're walking around where they're just anticipating, and they haven't actually learned how to become a victor. So I don't in any way diminish the objective events that they went through that were hurtful and harmful. Facts are what facts are. The person got raped. That's wrong. That's injurious. That's abusive. That's criminal. Okay. But how that the person then moves on with their life after that will determine whether they're a victor over the assault or whether they become a victim in their identity. And then that changes everything about how they approach life. And it may not be as overt as a rape, but simply bullying on a playground. And I know people that we've seen who their victimhood started because of the playground and because of the failure of the system to allow them to work it out. And you know how it was back in the movies of the 70s and the 80s? There was always the depicted bully on the playground picking on the kid, and the little kid got taught by his dad how to box or how to do karate, and he went back on the playground and kicked the crud out of the bully. I mean, this is how it was done. It was not for the purpose of
promoting violence. It was the purpose of the lesson was you stand up for yourself. You learn to overcome. You don't run from life's conflicts. That was the lesson that was being taught there, not simply to promote violence. But instead, they've taught this other thing. No, you run away and you bring authorities in and you have this safe space put up and you don't learn how to cope or manage or deal with life. And if you take the metaphor of the movie of the physical violence towards you learn your own intellectual and emotional ways to handle the bully.
Yeah.
So maybe I went off too big of a riff there, but I've seen this so many times that it really frustrates me. And with my patients, I've had so many successfully, they've actually shifted their identity away from victim to victor. And it makes a huge difference in their resilience and their ability to cope.
Yeah. I want to add on to what you just said. So here at Honey Lake, we have Hazel House, which is an adolescent girls residential program. And I was there for about a year working with the girls. And they are very capable when given the tools to resolve conflict and have conversations where they express how they feel, what they need, what the situation made them feel, able to apologize and work towards restoring trust and relationship. And so our program usually is, 9 to 15 girls at a time, all living in this house without technology for 3 months. And it's incredible. And so, I remember one specific situation where it was a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old girl. And I don't remember what one of them said, but one of them said something hurtful to the other. And the response was this girl who was the person that the thing was said to went around and told the other girls, this girl's a bully, don't talk to her. But because it's a small house and there's faculty hearing about everything, we were able to intervene and say, no, let's talk about this one-on-one. So I got to mediate a conversation between the two girls where each one was able to voice how they felt around the situation. And like what you were bringing up earlier, Katie, about, well, you said this to me last week, that's why I made this comment to you, right? And adding additional context and gaining experience with asking for additional context. And it was one of the cutest things I've ever seen, because at the end, both of them were like, oh, I understand you more. I want to be your friend. And it was so sweet. And after that, these two girls were able to have this really sweet friendship. But we followed that up with then as an entire group, all of the girls in the house having a group conversation about it. And what did we see? What was the social consequences of this misunderstanding? How did all the other girls turn against her? Why did you just believe what you were told? And so it ended up being this incredibly restorative experience. And I tell that story because I want people to understand what our adolescents are actually capable of.
But it required mature adult leadership.
Exactly. When they're given, and that's what I was going to say, is when they're given adequate support and education on how to do that, when they're led through it, they're actually able to do it really well.
Yeah, and structure. Even with the mature leadership, had you not had the structured environment, if you would have, had a mature leadership, but they could have just run to their room.
Exactly.
Okay, they probably wouldn't have engaged that conversation.
Exactly.
So it was both mature leadership, but also a structure that would not let them escape the conversation because it was an uncomfortable conversation. But once they had it, they were better off for it. And that's a part of parenting. And I think what stresses parents is that many of the parents don't actually have that confidence in their own ability to handle this. So maybe one thing that parents could do is just take some parenting classes and gain some of these skills to bring to home. Thank you guys for this conversation. We're just ran out of time. We've got to bring this one to a close. But thank you all for being in this conversation today. Thank you all for joining us. If you have questions, send those to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Come and Reason Ministries is celebrating 15 years of shared life-changing truth. And you're invited to be part of it. Now through August 31st, 2025, all our books, magazines, and children's resources are absolutely free, with free shipping anywhere in the U.S. Whether you're ordering for yourself or to share with your family, church, friends, or community, this is the perfect time to stock up and spread the message. But hurry, this special anniversary offer is only available while supplies last. Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.